So James Baer is one of our senior teachers here at Spirit Rock. Used that quote in his book, Awakening Joy, and I've used it in my book, Bouncing Back. And we come to this day in the context of the teachings of the Buddha, who said, I have come to teach one thing, suffering and the end of suffering. So I want to explore today the confluence of these paradigms of mindfulness or contemplative practice and psychology and neuroscience that allow us to develop a kind of response flexibility that is the key to meeting and moving through suffering. So I'm going to be looking at tools and practices from psychology and neuroscience that informs that, but also from our own tradition, and especially mindfulness and compassion, which simply happen to be two of the most powerful agents of brain change known to modern science. And that's because they help us develop response flexibility so that we can meet any suffering, any of the suffering that we're heir to in the human condition with more flexibility, more adaptability, and more skill. So I've been a psychotherapist in the Bay Area for 20 years now, and at the heart of clinical practice is providing guidance and tools to help people meet stress and trauma and tragedy and bounce back from adversity with this capacity of response flexibility so that we can meet the disappointments and disasters of our lives with being able to shift gears and make wise choices. And I've also been a student of Vipassana meditation and a teacher of it now here at Spirit Rock and other venues in the Bay Area for the last, studying it for 16 years, teaching it for 5. And at the heart of that practice, that path of practice, is equanimity, which allows us to meet any twists and turns in our lives, coming back to a center of groundedness and balance from which we can see clearly what's happening and we can see how we're reacting to what's happening. And it allows us to discern our options and make some wise choices. I've also been part of a neurodharma group for the last 5 years, which is a group of people who are interested in the confluence of neuroscience, contemplative practice, and psychology. We meet monthly and we explore tools that help us move through suffering, bouncing back from adversity. And I have been studying the neuroscience for about the last 12 years, especially in the lineage, if you will, of Dan Siegel in interpersonal neurobiology, which is studying how the brain grows in interactions with other brains and how our interactions impact the brain itself. So as we bring all these together, I do have a caveat from Richard Mendius, who also teaches here at Spirit Rock, that the field of neuroscience is so new, we must be comfortable not only venturing into the unknown, but into error. So everything that I offer today is in the spirit of the Buddha's teachings. See for yourself. If any of this is truthful and useful for you, then I'm glad for that. But remembering that in our practice, we have to be comfortable moving not only into the unknown, but into error. So neuroscience is a very new field. The tradition that we practice here is 2,500 years old. Neuroscience is 20 years old. The technology that allows neuroscientists to peek inside the black box and see what's happening in the brain as we respond in real time to real events is only 20 years old. That's one generation of research. And I wanted to read to you this passage from David Eagleman, who's a neuroscientist at Baylor University in Texas, about what we're learning about the brain. Your brain is built of cells called neurons and glia, hundreds of billions of them. Each one of these cells is as complicated as a city, and each one contains the entire human genome and traffics billions of molecules in intricate economies. Each cell sends electrical pulses to other cells up to hundreds of times a second. The cells are connected to one another in a network of such staggering complexity that it bankrupts human language and necessitates new strains of mathematics. A typical neuron makes about 10,000 connections to neighboring neurons. Given the billions of neurons, this means there are as many connections in a single cubic centimeter of brain tissue as there are stars in the Milky Way galaxy. The 3-pound organ in your skull, with its pink consistency of jello, is an alien kind of computational material. It is composed of miniaturized, self-configuring parts, and it vastly outstrips anything we've dreamt of building. So if you ever feel lazy or dull, take heart. You're the busiest, brightest thing on the planet. So as neuroscientists are learning what happens in the brain and how the brain structures work together, as we're watching scenes of combat on the evening news, or in an argument with our spouse, or we're mourning the death of a beloved pet, all these real life events that we have to cope with, they're teaching us that the capacities for resilience, for bouncing back, are innate in the brain. They're hardwired in by evolution. We all have them. And that those capacities are developed and strengthened by experience. Okay. So you probably know this drill by now, that any experience at all, positive or negative, will cause neurons in the brain to fire. When we repeat those experiences, we repeat the neural firings. The more the neurons fire together, the more they wire together, and they strengthen the connections between them. So that's how the brain creates new circuits and new pathways and even new structure. There's a lot that neuroscientists don't know yet about how the brain works. For instance, they have no clue. No clue whatsoever how the physical substrate of the brain causes the operations of the mind or consciousness. They have no idea. It's a mystery, and it may be a long time before they ever understand that. But what they do understand, and the best news in modern science, is neuroplasticity. That the brain has the capacity to grow new neurons lifelong and to create new connections among those neurons lifelong. We can myelinate the pathways, which is simply a fatty sheath that allows the processing of the neurons to go faster. We can rebuild brain structure and reorganize how the brain works itself. Now, we know that now. Until 15 years ago, the neuroscientists staunchly believed that once the brain developed into adulthood, it didn't change after that, that it was fixed, that you can't teach an old dog new tricks. So the discovery of neuroplasticity, that our brains change lifelong and that we can learn how to direct that change, is a huge paradigm shift. And it's a paradigm shift not only in science, but in how we do our practice. So that we learn as we set an intention and focus our attention and do practices like mindfulness and compassion and generosity and gratitude, we're actually strengthening the neural substrate in the brain that underlies those practices. The paradigm shift can be summed up by two leading thinkers. One is Paul Gilbert, who's a psychologist in the UK and wrote the book Compassionate Mind. Given our evolutionary legacy, 200 million years of the evolution of the human brain, reptilian, mammalian, primate, we're always going to have that. We're born with that evolutionary legacy. And there's a genetic loading. Each of us has genes that determine a lot of our behavior and our responses. There's the family of origin conditioning, and we have experiences early on that shape brain structure as well as laying down the pathways that shape our responses. And given the norms of our culture and society and what's expected of us in this time, in this gender, in this race, in this class, Paul says who we are and how we cope is not our fault. Okay? There's so many 10,000 causes upstream that determine who we are now. But given neuroplasticity and the choices that we can have about self-directed neuroplasticity, who we are and how we cope becomes our responsibility. And I want to share this quote from Richie Davidson, whose neuroimaging lab at the University of Wisconsin at Madison is the lab that has produced most of the data that shows the benefit of mindfulness and compassion in changing brain structure. And he says, the brain is shaped by experience. And because we have a choice about what experiences we want to use to shape our brain, we have a responsibility to choose the experiences that will shape the brain toward the wise and the wholesome, which is what we're here today to learn. Did I put this in? Charles Darwin also said, "It is not the most intelligent of our species that survives, nor the strongest. It is the one most adaptive to change." So we're here today to learn a lot of tools that will help us harness the neuroplasticity of our own brain and build the capacities so that we could become more resilient, more skillful in being resilient, and alleviate suffering for ourselves and for other people. So as we begin to look at suffering, it's important to know, as we all know, that suffering is inevitable in the human condition. We are all vulnerable to experiencing life's unwanted, disruptive changes. We will all experience some stress and trauma in our lives. Sometimes that stress or trauma comes from external stressors, things that happen outside of ourselves. So we lose our car keys or our wallet. Car needs a new transmission. Washing machine goes on the fritz. Or sometimes more serious challenges. Someone, ourselves or someone we know and love, loses a job, or gets a cancer diagnosis, or loses someone they love to illness and injury or suicide. And we face larger external stressors too, like the natural disasters that seem to be increasing as we face climate change and global warming. And like, for instance, the typhoon that hit the Philippines last weekend, or the tsunami and earthquake that affected the nuclear reactor in Japan, or Superstorm Sandy, or Hurricane Katrina. We're being asked to cope with all of these events that are external to us, but we have to find a way to cope. There are also internal stressors, and those can be the stories that we tell ourselves, that we're lazy, or that we're a klutz, or that nobody will ever love us or give us a good job. We have those stories going on in our heads. We also have implicit memories that reside in our unconscious of previous stress and trauma that we've had to cope with. And those implicit memories can rise up in our consciousness, and again, we feel the pain or the fear or the hurt or the anger. The thing that's tricky about implicit memories as an internal stressor is that they have no timestamp. Something happened back there and then, and it feels like it's happening here and now. And we're reacting to it as though it's happening here and now. So we have those kind of internal stressors. And how we respond to an external or an internal stressor is our stress response. Stress is our response to a stressor. And we're hardwired to do that. When there is perceived threat or danger, we are hardwired to go into our survival responses. We're never going to not do that. Fight, flight, freeze, appease, or to shut down, numb out, and collapse. This is how we have survived as a species. And this is how we survive as individuals. So when we learn how to work with the stress response, we learn that it comes from the lower brain, the evolution of our lower brain, meaning that it's completely unconscious, and it's fast track. It moves just in milliseconds. It moves so fast that it can preempt the coping of our higher brain, our conscious mind. And the conscious mind is much more comprehensive and much more complex and much more able to come up with elegant solutions. But it is slow compared to how fast track our survival responses can come along. And the survival responses are much less educable. The lower brain is not as neuroplastic as the higher brain. Though I will be teaching you a technique this afternoon that can rewire patterns that are even held unconsciously in our lower brain memory. So because the brain learns from experience, and it learns especially from experience in relationship, the brain develops in interactions with other brains. And initially, that's the only way it develops. And so our brain is a social organ. We're constantly learning in our experiences with relationships, and especially our relationships early on. So the early experiences that we had in our family of origin that begin to encode in our neural circuitry fixed by the time we're 18 months of age affect the expression of our genes, so whether we develop certain talents or styles or not. It affects the encoding of the patterns of response. So if we grew up in a family where anger was how people responded, we're going to learn how to do that. We can't help but learning how to do that. And it also determines the maturation of the brain structure. The response, the experiences that we have early on in our early relationships determine how well the brain matures as it grows and as we develop. So I want to do a quick thing here. I don't always talk about attachment styles unless I'm in a clinical training, but I want to be able to map that to the Buddhist teachings about the poisons. So this is 60 years of research on this one slide. When in our early experiences we actually have a responsive, empathic, attuned, protective, comforting, soothing, caregiving environment, we're able to establish what's called secure attachment. And we experience that as a feeling of safety and trust. There's a core feeling of safety and trust that becomes a basis of our resilience. The mind itself, the brain itself, stays stable and flexible both. So we're stable in our learning, but we're flexible, we're able to change. We stay open to learning, and we have what's called a flexible focus on ourself and on the world. We can focus on ourselves as we need to. We can focus on other people in the world as we need to. So that's the state that is primed to be resilient and to be neuroplastic. In the insecure avoidance style, if parents have been neglectful or indifferent or judgmental or critical, then we can develop a belief system that, uh-oh, people aren't safe and my feelings aren't safe, so I got to do this all by myself. So we become mistrustful of emotions and relationships. There's an over-focus and over-reliance on our sense of self or the world. And our brain functioning actually becomes a little rigid. We're not as open to learning, not as open to new experiences that we would require us to learn. And my colleague Bonnie Badenoch calls this neural cement. Right? The brain doesn't, it's not as plastic. In the insecure anxious, if parents have been unpredictable, sometimes they're, but sometimes not. Sometimes off in their own world, sometimes we are all about their world, then we can develop a style that feels more mistrustful of self and focusing on them. Will you love me? Will you need me? Can I get your attention? So that style tends to be more chaotic, and in the brain it functions a little bit more as neural swamp. Our patterns don't quite gel the way we need to. And then there is disorganized attachment if there's been trauma or abuse, and that's where people can just become checked out. There's a lack of focus, a kind of disintegration in the structure of the brain. How this can relate to our Buddhist teachings is when we can experience, or when our experiences have conditioned us to feel secure, it's fairly easy to tap into a sense of our true nature and our wiser self. We just know that to be who we are. And we do our practices often to recover that sense of that's who we truly are. The insecure avoidance style maps to the one of the three poisons of aversion or hatred, and that can become a style of how we move through the world. The insecure anxious maps to being greedy or grasping or clinging, and that can be how we move through the world. And disorganized, we're in the state of delusion or confusion. So our early styles of how we learn to cope can map to the Buddhist map of greed, hatred, and delusion. And when we do our practices of mindfulness and compassion, we're actually coming home to our true nature, to our true self, and more of that sense of security or inner trust that allows us to be resilient. So I've mentioned that mindfulness and compassion are two of the most powerful agents of brain change known to science, and the reason that they are is that they help develop the prefrontal cortex, which is the most important structure of the brain for resilience. It's right here, located where the third eye is. It is the executive center of functioning in our brain. It's how eventually we learn how to plan and make decisions and have good judgments, but it is also involved in our relationships and in our resilience, and I'll go over that in a minute. The prefrontal cortex has evolved the most recently in the human brain. In terms of evolution, it's the latest brain structure to evolve. It is the most complex and integrative brain structure. The development is kindled in relationships, early on especially, but lifelong. How we interact with people strengthens the functioning of the prefrontal cortex. It matures the latest. We don't fully have a mature prefrontal cortex until about 25 years of age into our early adulthood. Some neuropsychologists call it an evolutionary masterpiece, and I call it the CEO of resilience. So what the prefrontal cortex does, you can see why this relates to our resilience. It regulates the functioning of the body and the nervous system. So when we begin to rev up in a sense of fear, or anger or anxiety, or we begin to drop down in a sense of shame or depression, the prefrontal cortex is what regulates that and brings us back into a calm equilibrium, a calm baseline. The prefrontal cortex is what quells the fear response of the amygdala in the midbrain. So when we get frightened, having tools to strengthen and use our prefrontal cortex is how we calm down again. And I'll teach you some of those techniques. The prefrontal cortex is what manages all of our emotions, negative and positive, so that we're able to use them skillfully as signals to take action. Prefrontal cortex is what underlies the experience of attunement, where we get a felt sense of our feelings, what's happening in ourselves or happening in another person. And we need to be able to know that to be able to change our reactivity into responsivity. It's the foundation of empathy, which is not just understanding what someone else is experiencing or we're experiencing, but making sense of the story. It builds a coherent narrative of the story. Well, of course I understand why you would react that way. Totally makes sense to me. It's the foundation of our insight and self-knowing, how we're able to reflect and know what's going on with us and see our patterns. And it's the structure of response flexibility. So strengthening the prefrontal cortex is what allows us to change our patterns and become more resilient. And so mindfulness when we activate our attention circuit and compassion when we activate the resonance circuit, and I will talk more about both of those, strengthens the prefrontal cortex, increases our response flexibility, and allows us to alleviate suffering. So I'm going to have us do our first experiential exercise. And we'll be doing a number of exercises throughout the day. I would suggest that you practice these exercises with a sense of openness and curiosity and experimentation. If something I ask you to do feels outside of your comfort zone, then please, by all means, take care of yourself. Just simply sit and listen and observe and take your notes. But because the brain rewires because of experience, if you're willing to do the exercises, you may actually experience your brain rewiring. So the first exercise we're going to do is based on this quote from Theodore Rubin, "Kindness is more important than wisdom, and the recognition of that is the beginning of wisdom." So what I'm going to ask you to do, and okay, I think we can do this. In groups of three, you'll each take 2 minutes to share with your little group an experience of kindness that has happened to you recently. Somebody just did something that was kind and gave you that uplift of spirit and connection. And it could be this morning, it could be earlier this week, it could be back in the third grade. So each person has 2 minutes to share that story of kindness that you've experienced. And we go around the circle. And then I'll ask you to go around again, each of you sharing what it was like for you to tell your story and to hear other people's stories. And then we'll come back and I'll talk a little bit about the neuroscience, about why that's so helpful to us in strengthening our resilience. Is that clear what I'm asking you to do? So you get into a group of three, and then I'll ring the singers to have you move through, and then we'll come back. Okay. Introduce yourselves and decide who goes first.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.